For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation. No BS with the Bull, Manny Fernandez, worldwide in the VOC Nation Wrestling Network. I'm the voice of choice, Bruce Wirt, and with me as always for another week, the Raging Bull, Manny Fernandez. What's happening, Manny?
What's going on? I hope your Monday is a good Monday. My Monday's cloudy and rainy like it's been all month. I'm getting tired of it.
Yuck. Yeah, it rained the last couple times we did the show together. It's been raining like crazy down there for you.
And still raining. We just had a big thunderstorm and lots of rain. And all that does is get the mosquitoes worse.
Ugh. You're down by Houston, right?
About 40 miles from Dallas.
Dallas, okay. All right.
100 miles from the Louisiana border.
We never talked about this, but who's your preferred football team?
I played with Kansas City. I'll always be a Kansas City fan. Even though we got beaten in the Super Bowl this year, I'll always be a Chief.
You're not a Cowboy fan, though, right?
No, I don't. None of Texas sports, not the Rangers, not the Cowboys, not the Dallas Stars. No.
All right, good, because I'm from Philadelphia, and we couldn't be friends if you were a Cowboy fan.
No. One football team I hate the worst is Cowboys. America's team. I don't think they're America's team.
All right. Well, this week we're going to talk about Manny's time at CWF, Championship Wrestling from Florida. And I know a lot of you write in and you want to hear about Manny's work with Crockett. And we'll probably do a few weeks on that. We'll cut it up into different components and talk about different specific wrestlers that you worked with. So that's coming up soon next week for all of you that have written in. I mean, we have hundreds of correspondents that come in through various means. We will do a mailbag episode and Manny can answer your questions. If you do want to get us any questions for Manny or anything about Manny's career or people that he worked with, do me a favor and send an email to Bruce at VOCNation.com, VOCNation.com, or you can tweet us at VOCNation. Use the hashtag NoBS, NoBS, just all one word, and then we'll see it, and we'll try to get to as many as we can next week. We record, Manny and I usually record either on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. So if you want your stuff looked at, try to get it before Thursday night. And the shows drop, of course, on Monday. So that's what we'll do in the next couple weeks. So there you go. Manny, we know you started in Texas. You started with Funk and Murdoch, and they kind of brought you up to the business. Talk about how you ended up in Florida. What happened?
Well, you know, in the business in the old days, they called you had to pay your dues. You had to earn the respect of the people for you to move on. If somebody called another promotion, another part of the territory, and say, we got a good kid here. He's green, but he's good, and he's willing to learn. And, you know, that's basically what I did. I paid my dues. I did what I was supposed to do in Amarillo territory, everything they asked of me. And so Murdoch and them and Mulligan and the Funk, they called Eddie Graham and told him they had a good kid down here and might get over in Florida with a Hispanic background. Because, you know, there's a lot of Cubans back there in the 70s. Yep. In the 70s. And, that was it. They made the call. And I was told when I got they got the approval, like I was told when to go, when to show up, be there with my bag, be there ready to go, and that's what I did. I went, showed up, and checked in at the Florida office and talked to an old-timer named Charlie Lay and told him I'm coming in, reporting in. So that's basically how I got started.
And Charlie was the booker?
No, Charlie Lay was the old-timer that ran the office. He was like a secretary.
Okay.
You know, he answered the phones and that made sure all the guys that are supposed to be there to do TV were there, that Charlie, they had to sign in with Charlie. So I knew who was on for the TV taping.
So lay it out for the fans that aren't familiar. The NWA was comprised of a whole bunch of territories. This is the late 70s, right? You got there 79.
I got released from the Chiefs, and I'd already been training before that, before my release in the offseason. So, yeah, I got my release, and I went down there in 79. And, you know, it was – I think it was the start of one of the best parts of my life, really, to tell you the truth. There were so many opportunities for me in Florida, and you know, I had great people around me. And two great bookers, Jerry Briscoe and Dusty Rhodes. So, and a great owner and promoter in Eddie Graham. So it was a big learning curve for me, but I was excited about it.
So for younger fans, I think a lot of younger fans that started watching during the first heyday in the mid-1980s, they associate NWA with World Championship Wrestling, Jim Crockett Promotions, who was the dominant territory in that time period. But the NWA was made up of a whole lot of different promotions across the country. Bill Watts' territory obviously was a big one. You had Florida, you had Mid-South, you had Crockett. So where did Florida rank in terms of significant territories and TV visibility?
Well, you had nine territories. You know, you had all the Oklahoma territory, Louisiana territory, Texas territory, and you had down the line Florida and the NWA Mid-Atlantic, and there was nine territories, and Florida was one of the best. In the late 70s, Florida was one of the best territories to go to. Everybody wanted to come to Florida. It's hot. You can make money, good money. And as a rookie, you got taken care of by great talent.
Sure.
You got showed the way, showed the ropes. And Florida at that time was the hottest territory in the country, you know, with the way they were going about their business.
And each territory had their own distinct champion for that territory. And then there was one NWA champion that really ran around to every territory and defended the belt, right?
Correct. At that time, when I came into the business, it was Hardy Race. And, you know, he was a great champion. But, you know, they had all the individual champions, the Florida champion, Mid-Atlantic champion, and Southwest champion, Amarillo. They all had their own champion. They all had their top guy in the territory that was carrying the territory. And, you know, Florida had a lot of times, especially when they had Dusty Rhodes was hot in Florida. And, of course, Jack and Jerry Briscoe. And, you know, they had a bunch of good baby faces there, Steve Kern and Jimmy Garvin. And I came in that rookie class. They were a little ahead of me, Jimmy and Steve, because sure, they knew Mike Graham. They were good friends and went to school with Mike Graham. So they got involved early, you know, in the business before I got into it. But they were still kind of new. I think they were about a year, year and a half in the business or longer. And I was only like 6-7 months in the business, but it had a damn good crew and some of the top heels in the country. Some of the best heels you'll ever want to work. And when you were green, a young green kid, this is where you wanted to be to learn the business, because these guys carried you. When you got lost, they shut you down and made you understand that no, you're doing it wrong and you're going to go do it this way. That's some of the best heels you can work with, you know. Don Morocco's, the Bugsy McGraw's, the Mr. Pogo's, and, you know, Saito. They had a lot of great heels. Bad Leroy Brown. I had angles with some of the best heels in the country, you know.
So,
and then, of course, you had Terry and Dory Funk in there, and that was some real good wrestling.
Manny, so when each territory had their own champion, you had the NWA champion. Did the NWA governing body, I know, and we all know now that the business is a work, didn't know it back then, a lot of people, but they know now, the business is a work, so the NWA governing body votes on who the champion is going to be, the world champion. But each territory had autonomy on who their local champion was going to be, right? That wasn't governed by the NWA?
No. Like, the NWA was they had nine heads of the territories, almost like the mafia, and you had one president. And that president at that time was Eddie Graham. He was that president over the nine territories. And then they would sit down in a council meeting and they would discuss who could carry that world title belt, because the guy that carried that world title belt had to come into the territory with the territory's top guy and wrestle to make him, you know, prestigious, make him, you know, where the people believe in him. More says, you know, he'd carry the territory from there. And that champion, the world champion, had to be able to work good with the top guy in every territory. He'd come in and make that top guy. Not by losing the belt, by going our Broadway, 90-minute Broadway, having DQs, but he would come in and make a good push for the top guy of the territory. Like me. Buddy Ray's come in the first night we did. When I knocked myself out by acting, we're supposed to go an hour Broadway, you know, but I flew over the top rope and landed head first on the concrete.
Ooh. So,
that ended that early.
Yikes.
Yeah. But yeah, it was structured that way where they would make sure that the NWA world champion would be able to go in and boost the territory, make sure that it pops out.
All right. So everybody that you won't hear the part that was cut out, but Manny dropped because of the weather. So Manny, you were saying the champion would come into the territory and basically it was their job to make the local champion look good or vice versa, right?
Correct. To get him strong, over strong, for the people keep the territory going. Once the champion left, it was on that local champion to keep the territory strong, because he came in and had a heck of a match with the world champion. You know, that's what they did with all the good baby faces. Every good baby faces, you know, some territories like Florida had a lot of good babies. Dusty, of course, wrestled Hardy a lot, big draw. I wrestled Hardy a lot. Barry Windham, you know, the baby Steve Kern, you know, those guys had run with the world champions. So the territory stayed strong, because he made the baby faces look strong to compete with the top heels.
Sure. And explain to everybody that doesn't understand the difference between the promoter and the booker. So, you know, obviously you mentioned that Rhodes and Briscoe are the bookers. Eddie Graham is the promoter. A lot of people, you know, are familiar with WWE, where for years and years, it's not the same way now necessarily, but for years and years, McMahon is the promoter and Pritchard and Patterson are the bookers. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is the booker keeps the guys together. He keeps the angles. He comes up with all the angles to keep the territory strong and hot. He comes up with angles for the guys. He comes up with the matches. The promoter is the owner. The owner, and like an Eddie Graham, he just looks over their shoulder and makes sure that it's going in the right direction. Because he was a wrestler, too. He was a great talent, too, Eddie Graham. So he's always advising. He'll go, maybe he puts his 2 cents in when it's needed. But outside of that, he's just an owner, making sure that all the buildings are paid for, the arenas are good, and so we can sell them out. And that was mainly his job. But keeping this promotion on a straight and narrow is what the promoter does and the owner does. And, you know, every now and then he has an advice on somebody. And he would advise me a lot when I had matches with Harley and I would fly home with him. He would, you know, he'd be telling me, you know, think about the angles, think about what you're doing in the ring, take your time, don't be in a rush, you know, because he had a great mind about the business. But that's basically the difference. That ain't the difference as WWE, because I don't care what you say about Patterson and the idiot Pritchard, but Vince has the final play. Vince is, yes or no, everything. Vince is over everything. Eddie Graham was not. He let the bookers book. He let the bookers run the talent, the boys. and got the angles over and got the matches over. He let that. Every now and then, you know, a big show, he'd come in and say, okay, let's do that in Tampa Bay Stadium, or it's going to be a big, big show. Let's go get the stadium. Yeah, he'd come in there with his advice on things, and that's how it went. And of course, WWE ain't that way. It's Vince's way or the highway, right, where you get that your notice like all these people did. Then he gives you that line, good luck with your future endeavors.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, did you see all the talent? They released Braun Strowman, who was their top guy just what, less than 2 years ago. Not to, you know, just an aside, a little tangent there.
Who's Braun Strowman?
Well, there we go. That's how much Manny watches the modern product.
I heard from one of my guys, one of the guys that I trained in San Antonio, said on Facebook, wow, WWE released a lot of talent. And I saw the thing on there and I said, God, I don't know any of these people. Who are they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What it is, Manny? Back in the earlier days, wrestling was about the name on the marquee and names being significant. And Dusty Rhodes or Ric Flair or Hulk Hogan, people would come to see them. Randy Savage, people would come to see them. And they would draw fans in. And WWE tries so hard to not have any one person. They want it to be about the brand. And because of that, there's no superstars. I mean, there's people that get elevated, but then they are back down. And I think that's what, you know, besides the way the product has changed, it's very hard as a fan to really invest in people because there's really no mega stars anymore.
No, that's very true. I mean, the era of megastars is long gone because of WWE and Vince. You know, Vince puts them, elevates them for a while. They do something good, and then pretty soon they're not there no more. And before you know it, they're gone, and they're doing their little tours. WWE come meet and meet with WWE superstars. You know, they're doing all that. So it's like I said, you know, I saw the list of people being released, and I'm like, wow. I don't know any of these people. Who are they? You know, what did they do? I don't, you know, it's kind of strange in the business because when you went to territories back in the day, there was always somebody there that you were in that other territory that you build up together. And then eventually he shows up to that territory you're at. Like Barry went from Amarillo to Florida. I went to Florida first and Barry Windham came over there and we started picking it up like we did in Amarillo. Young guys making it hot. Getting, you know, the younger people, attracting the teenagers, younger people, stuff like that. And you always in the territories, when you went to another territory, you always ended up with two or three guys that you were in a territory before. So you always stayed close. It was a really good brotherhood. You know, it's what's missing since WWE did all this. You know, all the guys are pretty dang close. They hung out together. They drove together, traveled together, flew together. You know, it was a whole lot of difference now.
Right.
It's hard for me to imagine that wrestling wasn't, you know, the brothers of the road sharing the same load, taking care of one another, making sure all the families got needed. If they needed some, you got it to them. You know, it's just sad that that's all gone. It doesn't exist.
It's more like a Hollywood production than anything else.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, with that, you know, you got a lot of envious people and jealousy going on. You know, like when I started this business, Murdoch told me when I finally said, okay, I want to do it, let's train, get me trained to do this business. And when I agreed, he said, welcome to the most backstabbing business you'll ever be involved in.
Yeah. Yeah. And the stories are legendary. So you get to Florida in 1979. Give us a sense, what's that territory look like? So is it the whole state of Florida? Is it just a part of Florida? Where are the big arenas? And who's drawing the best? Yeah, give us a sense of what the territory looks like.
Well, tell you the truth, when I got there, I was nervous as hell. I was kind of scared because I saw the talent they had and I saw what they were doing. But when I was in Amarillo, they would get tapes, you know, the guys over there, and you go watch the tapes. They had some real good talent, and they had some strong guys in there, Killer Khan and you know, all the Japanese guys and the Vikings. I mean, they had some top guys, Bugsy McGraw and the top heels, Terry and Dory Funk. So it was kind of a scary point in my life. I said, where am I going to fit in? Well, you know, I fit in on the bottom. I started from the bottom up like everybody else. First match, second match, and going 15, 20-minute Broadways every night with Raul Mata, Don Soriano, great underneath guys. I mean, it's scary, and it was not just one part of Florida. It was the whole state of Florida. You went from Tampa to Tallahassee all the way to Jacksonville and beyond. Not too much farther beyond, but it was the whole state of Florida. So we had a lot of fun everywhere. Every little small town.
Did you work at all? Was Hogan or Arndorf there at that period of time? I think Hogan had left, right?
I would have loved to work with Arndorf because me and him became great friends later on down in Louisiana. But no, Hogan was still a mark trying to get into the business when I was there. He approached me a couple of the level 3 lounge a couple times asking me how to get in the business. I told him, go away. I'm 8 months in the business. You don't need to be asking me that shit. Get my ass fired or get my ass blackballed. Go away, dude. You know, but he was still trying to get in the business. That's the only thing I knew about him. But Orndorff was—he had just left to Louisiana when I got there.
Okay, so Orndorff gone. So major stars are—you said the Funks are down there. Dusty Rhodes is obviously there. Bugsy McGraw, who tragically died too soon. Killer Khan. Who else was on top there?
Wait a minute. I just talked to Bugsy about a year ago. You tell me, Pat?
Maybe I got it wrong.
You did, because he's in Daytona, Florida. And when I did that convention in Florida, he reached out to me and I said, oh my God, I haven't talked to you since 1980.
You know what?
we had a good angle.
Shame on me. We'll move on. I'm going to cut that out. Somebody died.
Don't keep me out there.
What? Yeah. All right. Let's move on. I'll just cut it. So tell me who else was running on top down in Florida, Manny?
Oh, yeah. Don Morocco, King Curtis, Joe LaDuke. All the Japanese, Saito, Sato, Takachiyo, which later became Kabuki. Well, he was Mr. Pogo then. I got a chance to work with every one of them and had fun. I learned so much, especially Don Morocco. Don Morocco, the original rock, man, he was unbelievable. He was unbelievable. But see, I started on the bottom. I had to work my way up to you know, fourth, fifth match. I was first and second all the time. They were seeing how I came along working with the older the Raul Mata, Don Soriano type veterans, working with them, going Broadways with them, seeing my attitude. It's always about testing your attitude. It's about testing your commitment to the business, knowing what it is. You know, you can't go out there and try to whip everybody's butt just because you have an amateur background. They won't put up with that. Jack and Jerry Briscoe have an amateur background, and I found out about that the hard way when I had a workout with them. You know, they were two-time national champions. Yeah. But that's what they had.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
VOC Nation takes wrestling fans behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Get stories and inside information from people who worked on the other side of the curtain. Follow the VOC Nation Wrestling Network podcast feed and get weekly shows from hosts like Bill After, The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, Ken Resnick, The Maestro, Shelly Martinez, Wes Briscoe, and more. Visit VOCNation.com for more information and follow us on Twitter at VOCNation.
They had a lot of great, Hiro Matsuda was there, but he wasn't wrestling. He was there an advisor. But they had a lot of great shooters in that territory, people that can hurt you and make you believe the business is real. And the way they worked, the business looked real. The Malenko, Boris Malenko and all them, they weren't wrestling, but they were in the outer perimeter of Tampa wrestling. And they were always there for advice. And if somebody needed to be handled, they could handle them, you know. But sure. That's what I liked about Florida territory, because every now and then, there would be a smart mouth guy talking and want to try out, and I just be up partying all night. Back in the 70s, Tampa had the bottle club. You could stay in the bar till 8 o'clock in the morning, then go to bed, and then somebody wake you up and say, "Manny, you need to be down there at the TV Sportatorium. We got some guy that thinks he can wrestle." And I'm like, "Oh my God, I gotta go do this. I got a hangover. I'm just gonna have to hurt somebody and come back to bed." So they had a lot of that in Florida. That's what Eddie Graham was all about. You doubted the business, he made you believe.
Sure.
And he loved Eddie Graham loved having his shooters. You know, like I said, Jack and Jerry Briscoe stayed there their whole careers. You know, they went to Carolina a couple times, Mid-Atlantic, but their whole investment was in Florida. And those two guys are awesome. They were awesome. You know, I enjoyed my there was when I started moving up from second and third match. The fourth match, I started doing a lot of six-man tag team matches with the Briscoe brothers, so I can learn how to tag in and out and everything. And their big deal was they always put me in the middle when their introductions, you know. I always had to stand in the middle, so when the referee went to check them, they'd raise their hands and slap the hell out of me. that was their big deal, and I started going, "What the hell?" Then I finally realized that was a big kick for them, so I let them get away with it all the time. You know, I didn't want to know heat. I was a green rookie, you know, and I had two of the best shooters in the country, and I was a green rookie, so I'd say, "What the hell?" So only a little slap in the face. But those two guys took care of me, took me under their wing, Jack and Jerry Briscoe, even Jerry being the booker, assistant booker, they took me under their wing. I traveled with them all the time. Every show I had to ride with them, of course. And they ribbed the hell out of me. They left me on the side of the road. I don't know how many times I got left on the side of the road. So,
what do they do? You stop to go to the bathroom, and then they take off without you?
Yeah. They call P-stop, and they go to get out the door, and I'm already out the door because I'm in the back seat. They're going to pee, and they just take off.
Okay. This is an era without cell phones. What do you do? I mean, you call it. You're on a pay phone. Huh?
There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do because they always let you out in the middle of nowhere. All you can do is start walking, and about 10 minutes later, here they come back and get you.
Okay, so you never got left high and dry. You never had.
No. They always that was a rib. That was the rib pull. That was their big kick. You know, ribbing the rookie. The one time we went out, and I love watermelon. One fruit I love is watermelon. I could eat 10 watermelons in a day. I could eat that many. And they knew that.
Yep.
They knew where it was. They knew where this watermelon field was. And they told me you could go pick some watermelons. Well, I didn't know that they knew the guy that owned the watermelon patch. So I go out there and I'm picking. They pop the trunk on their Lincoln Continental. And I'm how happy. I'm picking, you know, watermelons. I'm taking them to the trunk. I come back and all of a sudden I got a shotgun in my face. And I'm going, "Oh, my God." The guy, watermelon in the face. I look up at the guy and I'm like freaking out. He's got a shotgun. And then the guy starts grinning. I go, "Damn it, them damn Briscoes."
Oh, they set it up so he would do that to you.
They set it up. Yeah. They even set up one time when they got me arrested. Yeah, they knew all the cops in town. And I was at Tampa Bay, the Armory in Tampa, where and these cops came in to arrest me. Said that I was out all night and somebody complained about rape. I'm like, "Wait a minute, I know I was out all night, but I know I didn't do that." And then it was a rib too.
Oh boy. Man.
That's what the business miss more than anything. The business doesn't do that no more. They don't have that kind of fun. You know, it was kind of spooky, but then at the end, you know, it's a rib. When they start, you know. They were so great with their ribs as a rookie back in the day. You were going to get ribbed no matter what. They didn't care how tough you were. They didn't care what you've done in your life. They were going to rib you because that was just part of the tradition. That was tradition to them.
That's unforgiving. So what's the loop look like, Manny? Are you traveling from Jacksonville to Miami? What's the Florida territory? What are the major arenas?
Well, major arenas are the Miami, of course, Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, Bayfront Center, Tampa, Gainesville, the University of Florida. Oh, those are the big ones. Let me think of those. We had so many. Lakeland, Florida was another big draw for us, Lakeland. I mean, there were so many other spot shows, Stanford, Florida, Hialeah. I mean, we had millions of little spot shows that we do at the Hialeah arenas and stuff. But the main shows, like Miami, we never drove Miami. We always paid $50 a piece. Six guys would fly in a twin proper in one of the beach crafts and go flying, me and Garvin and Kern and Dusty and Jack and Jerry Briscoe. We'd all go fly to Miami on that. We'd all pay $50 a piece and go fly and come home all drunk and try to get home. But it was fun back in the day because, like I said, you got to travel. And of course, you're going to get ribbed no matter what, you know. You're going to get ribbed because you're still green. And even though Kern and Garvin were kind of green, they'd almost been in the business 2 years. I hadn't been in the business 8 months. So you're green as hell, even though you can work because the people that taught you how to work and you know how to work, they're still going to treat you as a green rookie. And that's what I loved about the business. I kind of enjoyed, I knew the ribs, you know, half the time you know they're coming, but you let it go because, you know, it's the thing. It's just, it's tradition. And, you know, then some people nowadays became us. You try to rib them and they're all like, oh, I don't believe in that kind of stuff. That's not cool. It's how stupid people have gotten, you know?
Yeah, no, it's camaraderie is definitely lost. And it's not just wrestling. It's, I mean, there, I can see where, I mean, there was some ruthless pranks where people are getting hurt, but fun ribs that are, you know, not hurtful, are just part of being a team and getting to know each other and having fun, right?
Right. It's, you know, like Steve Kerr super glued my boots to the ground. Those kind of ribs. Or they lock your bag, they get up, they find a locker. You're doing a high school show and somebody left their locker unlocked. They take the lock and lock your bag to the locker. You have to cut the handle off to take it home. These are harmless ribs, but it was fun back in the day. Back in Florida was one of the biggest ribbon territories in the country. You had to, every now and then you get Sir Oliver Humperdinck and Bugsy McGraw, Bad Leroy Brown. They'd pass you up down the highway when we drive to Orlando, because Orlando not that far from Tampa or Jacksonville. We drive there. They'd pass you up on the highway and they shoot their guns over the roof of your car. Bam, bam, bam. You know, you're like, oh, what the hell? But, you know, that was fun stuff. To us, that was fun. I mean, to normal people, that would be scary thing to do. But to idiots like us, that was fun. You know, then we all got our guns and started shooting everybody.
Oh,
shooting
boy.
At everybody. I mean, that was the Florida territory. We had some bad, me and Barry had a real bad wreck in my little Volkswagen pickup truck that I got. We flipped it 8 times. Thank God we didn't get hurt. I just had stitches under my chin. But we did some silly stuff. Florida was a hot territory. All the boys were close. Everybody had no problems with one another. And Jerry, to tell you the truth, Eddie Graham ran a tight ship, very tight ship. He believed in kayfabe to the max. You did anything to break that, you were gone. You were gone that day. You were dead. That's how strong that territory was. But, you know, you're talking about talent. You're talking about guys like Morocco and King Curtis and Joe LaDuke and Bugsy McGraw and Terry and Dory Funk that came in. And, of course, you're younger underneath the heels. You know, those guys are pretty good, too. The guys that made you get through the first and second match when you first got there so you could prove yourself to the booker. That's basically what it is. But
so, Manny, who were some of your – well, before I get there. We talked about the arenas and explain this in the old territory system. So you're paid on the gate, right? There's no guaranteed contracts like there are today. So I'm assuming, you know, you get your big payoffs on the big towns, and the small towns, you just work because you have to work. And I mean, is there any towns on the loop that you're like, oh boy, I got to do this, but you have to do it because you're not going to get to the big shows if you don't put in the time at the little shows. Is that how it worked?
No, that's not how it worked in Florida. Every town, Florida was so hot, everywhere we went was a sellout. So, you know, as a rookie, you know, I came from making 25, when I started making $25 a match, you know, part of the, they pay you by the gate, correct? 50% goes to promotion and 50% goes to the boys. If you're having sellouts and a little armory, which holds 400 or 500 people, you're still going to make $200-$300 for that night as an underneath guy. You know, the top guy will probably make $1,000, but you're going to make $200 or $300. And, you know, you're talking about 7 days a week, twice on Sunday. If you're making $200-$300, you're still making $1,600 a week, you know, in a hot territory like that. So if you're still underneath, that's a good pay week. That's good money for a guy underneath, you know. And the top guys, yeah, they're making $4,000 or $5,000. They're having a better week. But as being underneath, making that kind of $1,500-$1,600 a week, think about that. And think about the expenses of 79. 79, it was not, you know, gas wasn't $3 a gallon. Gas wasn't even $1 a gallon, you know. So, you know, the expenses, your rent and everything, places were $300, $400 a month. You could live good. You could live good.
Now, when guys went to a different territory, so when you went to Florida, I'm assuming you didn't have a family, so you just kind of pick up and move. How did guys do it that had families? I mean, would you pick up your family and move to the territory when you changed territories?
Well, eventually they do. First, they go into the territory and get themselves settled. They leave their family there where they've already been settled. Okay, in a couple months, then when they got settled, got a place with the family, and know they were making steady money, they would bring their family in. Yes. But it wasn't right away, unless you were just a husband and wife. I was by myself, so, you know, I wasn't married to nobody.
And then how did you decide where to live? Did guys decide based on the main arena at that town or where the office was? How would they figure it out?
Wherever you decided to move, whatever part of the city, like in Tampa, you know, the Briscoes live way out in the country. They went way out in the country out there. And I kind of lived towards them in a real nice complex there, an apartment. Then I bought, when I started getting Main Event, I bought a house over by them, by the lake. You know, I messed with the Gators a lot, throwing rocks at them all the time. But that's what most people got where they were comfortable. It wasn't a thing. I think the only time I went, and we'll talk about that later, but the only time I noticed where the boys were cluttered together, they wanted to live on top of one another, which I never did, was the Mid-Atlantic territory. Everybody wanted to be near each other. You know, everybody wanted to be close together, close to the office and everything. But that's the only time I've seen that. But other than that, wherever you felt comfortable, you live. Wherever you felt you could stay and be at peace, that's where you live.
Yeah, because you're making the loop, right? You're constantly on the road almost every day. So it didn't matter.
Yeah, you're based in Tampa anyway. That's your hometown. Okay. Tampa's a hometown. That's where the office was. That's the base of the office. So anywhere the office was, you're going to live inside that city. You know, San Antonio, the office was on Blanco Road. So everybody lived around 5 miles of that perimeter. You know, and basically, you're going to be based in San Antonio, based in Tampa, based in Kansas City, or anywhere you're going in Baton Rouge, anywhere you go. That's where the office is. You're basically going to be based from there, and that's where you go from. That's where you take your team. All the boys meet up to ride together at a certain restaurant or a certain department store. You hook up and drop your car off, jump in the other car, and you're off to the town. Unless you're flying, of course, then you all meet at the airport.
For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation. So, all right, you get there in 79. You say you work on the bottom of the card to start. Who's the champion when you come into Florida? Is it Terry Funk?
Terry Funk was the Florida heavyweight champion, yes.
And
yes. Southern heavyweight champion was Dickie Slater. And then the tag champions were the Japanese guys, Sato and Saito. And I don't know who else was. It's a while back. I'm old now.
Yeah. No. I'm just trying to paint the picture. You say Slater's the Southern heavyweight champion. Is that the belt just under the Florida heavyweight championship?
Yes, just under the Florida heavyweight. Yeah. So the TV title, Southern, the Florida heavyweight title, and the tag title, they were all kind of strong. Everybody that had a title in Florida, they were strong. All the titles. You could put the tag champions in the main event one night, and then the Southern champion main event. It all meant something. It all carried weight. That's the thing about that back then. All the titles carried weight. Everybody that had the title had to make sure he was a strong champion. So he carried the weight, and he'd be able to be main event on a certain show at a certain time, and everybody carried their belt, you know. So we drew money that way. That's how he stayed strong. Dickie Slater was a hell of a wrestler. He was a hell of a champion. He was a tough guy, very tough guy.
By the way, so that Bugsy McGraw doesn't get angry with me, I was thinking of Rick McGraw, who died in 1985. Yeah, Bugsy, but Rick. Yeah. Quick draw, Rick McGraw.
Yeah, him, yeah. Because I was going like, I know, I had some of the best, when I finally got to main event, semi-main event, when Dusty was giving me the push, I had some of the greatest, funniest matches in the world. And I knew Eddie Graham was dead against you laughing in the ring. When I would wrestle Bugsy, I had to bite my tongue almost because he did especially his Three Stooges act. Every time I would nail him with the flying elbow, and he'd go down and do the spin around like Curly used to do. Oh my God, I would almost die. I had so many memorable matches with him. I had so much fun with Bugsy. He was so good and thick as a moose, man. But he was a great, great champion too. And then, of course, he had Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I thought Sir Oliver Humperdinck in my book and territory and my time in all the territories was one of the greatest managers around. I thought just his manner, how he took care of his guys, how he took care of himself in the ring, how he took bumps and how the heat and how he got heat and kept his heat. It was unbelievable. He was an unbelievable manager. I've never seen a better manager.
And this happened a lot up north, but until they took Oliver Humperdinck, who was a vicious, notorious heel, and made him the manager, the face manager of Bam Bam Bigelow in WWF circa 1987. And he's wearing tie-dye or whatever they did to him.
Yeah. I remember that. I was teasing him about it one time when I saw him, you know. But he and Bam Bam Bigelow.
Yeah.
He's good with Bam Bam.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. So Manny, you're there, Terry Funk's the champion. And, how long did it take before they decided they wanted to work you on top as the Florida heavyweight champion?
Almost a year. I was almost a year in the business, I should say. It was Terry Funk. That's why I thank Terry Funk every day, every time I see him, when we have a sit down. Yeah. Cause it was his decision to do it. By then, I was already working. I had tag matches, you know. Like I said, I had six-man tag matches with Jack and Jerry Briscoe, and those were awesome matches against the Japanese, and especially when they would chase around Masao Hattori, the little Japanese manager, and pull his pants off and stuff. So they'd pants him in the middle. He'd be fighting like hell for them not to take his pants off, but he always lost that fight. But, you know, I went from there. Then I tagged up with Dusty a few times, and they were just slowly grooming me, making sure I was ready, putting me in tags with the top guys like that. And then, you know, Russ and Bugsy by myself and Morocco by myself, you know, just trying to get me established. They got me established, and the one that got me over the hump was Terry. He decided in Orlando, Florida, that I was doing a small package in me to put that title on me. So basically Terry. And to this day, I thank him for what he's done. And you know, I tell a lot of people, you should be grateful. Terry made you. You know, you got a chance to wrestle the greatest, and he put you over. He made you. You know, he made you. You should be grateful for that.
You know? And how long did you hold the belt, Manny?
About a year. So we did that angle with Don Morocco and Ernie Ladd.
So, and yeah. Tell people that aren't familiar. So you hold the belt for a year, and how's the setup when you're going to drop the belt? So, and talk through the angle as much as you remember.
I can't tell you. That's kayfabe, man.
Well, no. So how did it set up on TV? So you're going to drop the belt to Morocco, right?
Yeah. Me and Don had matches for the Florida heavyweight title for a while. We had a program going for like 3 or 4 months, and Don was after me, and I'd always get out of it by the skin of my teeth. He'd slip on a banana peel, all that. That's what I always loved about Don Morocco. This guy could get beat every night. Every night he could beat Don Morocco, but he had more heat than anybody in the territory. He got more heat getting beat than anybody I know. He just kept his heat. He just kept his heat. And, of course, he had Humperdinck, too. So that helped out. So, you know, what it was they brought in a bounty. Humperdinck supposedly paid Ernie Ladd to come in and interfere in the match on the bounty on me with that. That led up to my program with Ernie Ladd. But Ernie Ladd came in off a double knockout, and he had a mask on. And, you know, he had a mask on and came in. And while I was knocked out, he came off the top rope and landed and splashed me. And put Morocco on top of me for 1, 2, 3. And, you know, people went crazy in Miami. So I almost started a riot. Almost started a damn riot. But then, of course, you know, a camera crew was around. They were sneaking around the camera crew. All of a sudden, they popped up, and they went in the dressing room, and they caught Humperdinck paying Ernie Ladd a ton of money for what he did. And that's what that led up to the my teeth, my jaw. That led up to the angle with me and Ernie Ladd. And that was a fun one, too. I had a great time in Florida. I had great, you know, you talk about the guys that I got to wrestle, Ernie Ladd, Don Morocco, King Curtis, Joe LaDuke, you know, Terry Funk, Dory Funk, Cheese, I almost forget, Harley Race, almost forgot the main man, Harley Race, you know, I mean, it was unbelievable territory. I got educated, number one. I learned the business the right way. I learned to respect it more. I learned to love it more. And I learned that you want to take care of one another, no matter your ideas or your dislikes. When you're in that ring, you take care of your business. That's what you're there to do.
Yeah,
that's what I learned.
By the way, Ernie Ladd, you know, he was played and very successful in the NFL. Wrestled really starting at the same time in 1961. Just looked like a fun guy to be around. Was that the case?
Yeah, he was funny as that. I used to laugh because when we started, he beat me down. When I started my comeback, I'd fire off gut punches, bam, 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 to the gut, bam, and then go to top. By the time I went to top, he was already selling his head. I hadn't had he was grabbing the side of his ear. I'm going, damn, I haven't hit you yet. I mean, I'm telling you, man, the most fun I had probably in the territory was Florida. Guys are crazy. I remember Don Morocco would get me and shove Quaaludes down my throat when I was a rookie. Open your mouth, kid. Boom, I feel that. And he said, now swallow. And I'd swallow. And pretty soon, about 10 minutes, I was all buzzy.
Oh, my Lord. Wow. Ernie Ladd played for a couple teams, but played for the Chargers, didn't want to play for the Chargers, had a contentious relationship, and then decided to leave and never come back. And he became a full-time wrestler, I think, starting in 67, right?
Right, right.
And had a great career, wrestled, I believe, until 86. Yeah, WrestleMania 2 was his final appearance, right?
Right. I didn't keep up with him much later. I just knew Ernie when his background was the Chiefs, you know, because he was, you know, in the honor circle in the Chiefs. Ernie Ladd, Curly Culp, Willie Lanier, all them guys that played with the Chiefs when they had their run with Hank Strang.
Yep.
I knew about it because it was in the Chiefs, but I didn't really keep up with it once they were gone, you know, and Ernie left the territory and I went to San Antonio. You didn't really keep up with him. And the every territory that I went after that, I didn't see Ernie at all.
So I'm sorry. He did no show that with the Chargers, lost a dispute with the league, suspended from football, came back in 66, played for the Chiefs in 67, and then transitioned into pro wrestling full time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just a tremendous athlete. You know, he was a big man, 6'9", 300 pounds. And they called him the Big Cat because he could move, right? He was a big guy that could move.
Oh, he was quick. Yeah, he was agile. Very agile for his size. He was like Mulligan. Him and Mulligan surprised me because they're all 6'9", 300-something pounds, and they could move. They were so agile. They did, you know, they could basically do anything a 200-pounder guy could do.
So after you dropped the belt to Morocco, how much longer did you stay around Florida before you moved to the next spot?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a little return matches with Morocco, of course.
Yep.
A couple of return matches. Then I started working against Dory. Dory was the Southern Heavyweight Champion, so we had a couple of things going on with Dory. When Dusty left, Dory took over the booking, okay. And Wahoo would come. We had a big show in Miami. And I had the Japanese Pogo. We had a big show in Miami, and Wahoo came down from San Antonio, and Bill Watts came down from Louisiana, and this big show in Miami. It was a really good big show. And I wrestled Pogo, and we went out there, and Watts and Wahoo were watching the match, and I was it was a hell of a match with Pogo, and they both come back. And I didn't know Dusty was leaving as the booker after the big show in Tampa with Harley Race, Last Tango in Tampa. And Dory was taking over. But Wahoo and Watts were interested in getting me to their territory, especially because in San Antonio, it's all tons of Hispanic people.
Right.
Got a ton of Hispanic people. And they came in there and they asked me, I said, I don't know. I got, you know, Dusty, you know, the booker, and I can't just say I can go. I didn't know. They approached me, but I didn't know how to respond to that.
Right.
You know, I still grew. I was still less, a little over a year, and almost 2 years in the business, but I was still green to the fact that I didn't know how to go about, you know, saying, hey, I want to give my notice. But,
right.
You know, I talked to Terry and talked to Wahoo, and Terry thought San Antonio coming back to Texas would be the best deal. So, and then Dusty left and Dory was there, and Dory still had me on top working. I went in and told Dory. I think I got a little heat with him when I told him that I had to go to, that I would like to give my notice to go to San Antonio and work for Wahoo. So I don't know if I think I got a little heat for saying that, or doing that, but I was already, I wanted to come back to Texas anyway. So that's how that happened.
And then you did that, what, 82, you went back to San Antonio, or you went back to Texas in San Antonio.
Yeah, San Antonio.
San Antonio. And that's where we'll leave it, Manny. That's the story of Manny Fernandez in Florida. And we'll pick it back up at some point and take it to the next phase in San Antonio. But before that, we'll stop off and answer some mail. We have a few hundred pieces of mail virtually or electronically to look through. So we'll either do one or two mailbag episodes. We'll get through the Crockett years, of course, because people keep asking about that. And there's a lot of Manny Fernandez left. So stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Yep. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Manny. Great to, I'm honored to do this show with you every week and having a good time. So let's just hope that the people keep tuning in to listen to the stories. And I think the best is yet to come. A lot of people asking about the Crockett years, so that'll be a good time. And I think we'll have some fun answering some fan questions, the ones that we can answer, because, you know, fans get a little crazy sometimes with their questions.
Yeah, they're gonna, they got the right to. That's why they're fans. I mean, but you can ask stupid questions, and you can answer logistically. I mean, you can ask them proper, even though they're stupid. You just tell them, well, you know, everybody's got their own opinion. Everybody's got their own way of life, you know.
Yep.
But, yeah, I really enjoyed, you know, I didn't say a lot of the stuff. Ribs, they're real bad ribs in Florida. pooping in bags. Somebody pooping in the bags, putting dead snakes in bags.
Oh, boy.
Because in Florida, in the summertime, you know, there's snakes all on the road. And they all get run over. And we used to pick them up, me and Kern and Garvin. And we knew the Frenchie, the guy that took care of Andre later on. He was a great referee for us in Florida. We knew we were scared of snakes, and we put him in his bag. And one time he started shooting at us.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we had fun. Florida was a fun part of my life, very fun part of my life.
Well, we'll keep doing it, Manny. Great week here talking about Florida and the career of Manny Fernandez. Remember, if you want to drop a question for our mailbag episode or two, tweet VOC Nation, at VOC Nation, use the hashtag NoBS, or send an email to bruce@vocnation.com. That's it for this week on No BS with the Bull. For the Raging Bull, Manny Fernandez, I'm the voice of choice, Bruce Wirt. We'll talk to you next week on No BS with the Bull, right here on the VOC Nation Wrestling Network. For over 10 years, VOC Nation has taken listeners behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. Our hosts are not only experts on the business, but have lived in the business. Subscribe and hear weekly podcasts from hosts like legendary pro wrestling journalist Bill Apter, former Impact Wrestling star Wes Briscoe, former WWE and AWA broadcaster Ken Resnick, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, former WCW star The Maestro, NWA legend The Raging Bull Manny Fernandez, and much more. VOC Nation programming is free on most major podcasting apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Radio.com. And video podcast and bonus content is available on Patreon for as low as $3 a month. What are you waiting for? Head to VOCNation.com and dig into the most comprehensive podcast network built for pro wrestling fans. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at VOC Nation Wrestling Network, and follow us on Twitter at VOC Nation.